And there'd be times where I would be going after a shoplifter and I'd grab them and then I'd see a blur to the side. So I'd duck and then there'd be someone on the side of me trying to punch me. So now this is a shoplifter. This guy assaulted me. Shoplifter gets to go home. Now the guy assaulted me. He's the one I'm taking in.
What's up, everybody? Thanks for supporting the Pohada Podcast. This is a show where we talk about jiu-jitsu with jiu-jitsu people, very often black belts. This time around, I'm talking with Greg Nelson, a black belt in jiu-jitsu, among, as you'll hear, pretty much everything else. Outside of doing every martial art under the sun, his skill set and coaching is also informed by some real-life violence and twice winning the bad motherfucker belt over cancer. Before we jump in, this episode is brought to you by Way of the Tiger Soap Company, a small business created by one of us. If you train jiu-jitsu, you need good soap, and this is it. I actually keep a bar in my office as an air freshener as well. The show is also brought to you by Hamel Jiu-Jitsu Club in Hamel, Minnesota, just off Highway 55. If you haven't visited yet, on April 13th, Ishmael Bentley, an early student of Greg's, is giving a seminar, which is free and in the gi. Check out the Facebook page for details. And of course, shout out to The Academy for allowing me to record this and several other episodes recently. And without further ado, my conversation with Greg Nelson. Greg, you ever been in a fight?
Yes.
Tell me about it.
Well, I've been in a lot of them.
Okay.
And I think the biggest part of it initiated when I started training really formal martial arts in 1983, and I was doing Filipino martial arts, Jun Fan martial arts. We started Thai boxing right after that. Since I was 10, I wrestled. So everything was, you know, gravitated towards self-defense back in the day. I wanted to know how to fight better. Then I had an opportunity to work at Target Lake Street as a apprehension of shoplifters guy, right? So
loss prevention, they
yes,
call it.
Yes, loss
days.
Prevention, yeah. Assets protection. It changed many words, but the function was the same. And from 85, 86, 87 through 90, that's when I worked at Target Lake Street, and then I'd go to, and then I also worked at the Broadway Target in Northside, and then every once in a while I'd be called into the Midway Target, and they're all about the same.
Yeah, all really nice spots.
Yes. And so lots of action there. And so pretty much every day you'd work, you'd have something. But I'd always tell people this, like, let's say if you had 20 shoplifters. Out of that 20, probably 10 would try to run, which is that's not really a fight. It's just a tackle, grapple, get them back in. Once they're tackled and they've wiggled around a little bit and they can't get away, they're like, okay.
You think would be the store policy today to chase them?
Or I have something that really determined why we don't do that anymore.
Sure. Go ahead.
But, and then out of that, there'd probably be out of that 20, there'd be a couple, one or two, that would be a scrap. That person's done running, they're turning around, fists are up, we're fighting. And then you got to practice actual fighting where you had to figure it out. And interesting thing, you didn't want to go down on the pavement a lot because A, it's pavement. B, they always had somebody with them. So you might, I mean, having a wrestling background, it was nice because I could pick somebody up and just fling them and they'd land on the ground.
Yeah, they have no idea that's coming.
No. And so then you just let them go and you didn't have to follow them down. And then you could survey and see who was around. If there's nobody around, then you could go down and grab them. If there was, you'd do it again. And then maybe do it again.
Hit them and then hit them and then hit them.
Yes.
Okay.
And there'd be times where I would be going after a shoplifter and I'd grab them. And then I'd see a blur to the side. So I'd duck. And then there'd be someone on the side of me trying to punch me. So now this is a shoplifter. This guy assaulted me. Shoplifter gets to go home.
Mm-hmm.
Now the guy assaulted me. He's the one I'm taking in.
Yeah, it's a bigger prize.
Bigger prize. And right. So, and plus it's just the smarter prize because this guy's just trying to run to get away. This one's trying to attack you. So then there was a big thought process. It was like, bam, there's the fight over here now. And so you're working there for, you know, 5 years, for, you know, 20, 30 hours a week. There was a lot of scrapping going on. And there was a crack epidemic too. So the gangs were coming up. So there was a lot of opportunities to see what worked and what didn't work. And so
the ultimate fight lab.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And then in 90, I went to California for about 4 or 5 months to train out there. And then when I came back, that's when all the policies changed. And the reason behind that, because there was a guy at the Broadway Target. He ended up stealing a bunch of stuff, took off running. They chased him. He ran and stopped at Broadway, and a truck with an extended flatbed pegged him off in the head.
Hold on. Say that again.
So he stopped to get, you know, waiting for this truck to go by, but yep. It had an extended flatbed, which hit him in the head.
Ooh.
He bounced off, flew in the air, lost an eye, got brain damage, but did not die. So he was able to sue Target for an mm-hmm. undisclosed amount of money. And at mm-hmm. that point in time, they were like, just let him run.
Cheaper, big picture to let him run.
Yep.
He's stealing chapstick anyway or something. Whatever.
It was funny because I still remember what he stole. 4 VHS tapes because they were expensive back then.
Yeah.
And so that was it. And after that, it was like, if they get off the sidewalk, at first it was, if they got off the sidewalk into the parking lot, that was it. You couldn't go after them. Now it's like if they even touch the doors, I think, or walking out the doors. You know, and, obviously that's where you have security guards or asset protection, loss prevention, whatever, that's hired by Target. But if you have outside contractors that have a big insurance policy, depending on where you're at, they can do different things. So, but Target is more or less in Dayton's or Marshall Field's or the big giant stores. They're like,
Let them go. Cheaper, safer, and cheaper.
Not as fun.
Yeah, definitely not as fun. So obviously this experience informed your interest in martial arts, or this is happening at the same time?
It happened at the same time. Okay. So it's like you said, it was like a perfect lab mm-hmm.
yeah.
to really yeah. figure out what's going to work, why it's working against multiple opponents, dealing with different environments because you're on sandy pavement, you're on nice sunny day pavement. You're in the middle of a rainstorm. It's the winter. It's icy. Every possible thing that might happen in weather environment, you are fighting on tile. Right. And so it was really a huge part of my, martial arts development in what worked in self-defense, what was fanciful and what wasn't.
Sure.
And again, it comes down to higher the risk, the simpler things are, the better. Yeah. And you start to figure out, and I was doing jujitsu at the time, I just started, but we were doing shoot wrestling, which is a lot of grappling and wrestling. But you realize pretty fast that when there's more than one person and there's a lot of chaos going down, the ground is not the best place to be.
Right.
And it's still, you think about the riots when the riots are going on and mm-hmm. then you're on the ground. That would be terrifying. You would have no idea what's going on. However, is there a possibility that you're going to slip, trip, fall, get punched, and then you're on the ground? Yes. So therefore, you better know how to deal with that as well. And the mindset for me, and even is today, when you're thinking about like MMA, you don't want to stay on your back and try to fight. You want to try to fight up and fight to get to a top position where you can do more damage. And in a street fight scenario where you may have multiple opponents, I'm going to probably opt to fight to get to a position where I can either reverse it and get on top or reverse it and get to my feet so I can, again, move and figure out, is it going to be better to run because there's 5 guys? Or, okay, I have my kids here. I can't run. I got to fight. But I want to have the ability to maneuver and deal with what I got
to
deal with.
You're stuck between 5 guys. It's better to be stuck between 5 guys as is rather than 5 guys and the ground.
Yes. Yeah. Big time.
So where did you do in California that year?
I just trained. I went out to Inosanto Academy, okay. Trained with Eric Paulson. And, you know, we grew up competing together in gymnastics because he's a graduate out of Coon Rapids and then moved out to California after he started with Rick Fay at the Collie Group in like 84. And so that's, I remember when he first came in, it was funny because Rick Fay and I were sparring because we used to spar in the afternoons and we heard this knock on the door and it was Eric, but I didn't really know him. I remembered him from gymnastics because we competed against each other. And I opened the door and I go, yeah, what do you want? Oh, I just wonder if I could come in. When we're done sparring, we slammed the door on his face and went back in and locked him out until we were done sparring. And he always tells the story.
Hung around or came back?
He stayed out there until we were done.
Okay.
And then he came in and then obviously Derek Paulson.
Yeah. You know, turned into what it turned into.
Yes. And so and when he went out and when he moved out to California, that's when he just was immersed in that environment and just became who he is. So and we remained friends the whole time and still to this day, just really, really good friends.
So in terms of the timeline up to this point, this trip to California, let's say, what all have you trained? You wrestled
growing up? Jun Fan martial arts, Filipino martial arts, Thai boxing, Savate, Wing Chun, boxing, Sealot, Kabikabong. You know, so it was just this quest of finding martial arts, training them. And for me, it was all about just learning the martial arts and having a blast doing it because I had the ultimate lab to go fight for real so I could play all I wanted because I knew what worked and what, and I'd take from all those different arts and say, wow, this would probably work in a really good, this would be a good thing. But it was just super fun doing all these other things. And so there was never this idea that I was going to pull off some kind of trapping sequence in a fight. But yeah. I learned how to understand how to navigate, touch hands, be on the hands, and not give the person the opportunity to do something. So through those drills, through Chi Sao, through Hubud from Filipino martial arts, through the Sombrada, Filipino training methods with the stick, you're learning how to track hands and monitor hands and be aware of everything that's going on around you. Meanwhile, you're still trying to hit the person in front of you. They're trying to hit you. And it's like everything kind of wires into this, in my brain anyways, it always wired back into how is this going to work in a fight? Well, we're going to find out in about 4.5 hours when I go to work, right? So
it's funny, that's the opposite to most people. Exactly. They sit on their ass at a desk and then they go learn to fight.
Yeah, yeah.
You're practicing fighting and then you go learn to fight.
Yeah, so it was really a perfect blend of being able to train and be super creative, absorb what is useful, reject what is useless, add what's specifically your own, have a blast doing it, and then go fight and then figure it out and come back. And I remember every day when something would happen, I'd go back and I'd see Rick Fay. I go, Rick, you got, he goes, what'd you do now? No, here's what happened. And so it'd be some kind of story about, what I learned and, we gotta create a drill for this. Because this was a really crazy scenario. And so that's also how we would create drills and come up with things and make it more, I guess, friendly to the people that are coming in, but would still give them the attributes that would be necessary to potentially have to fight.
Yeah. Workable, but also real.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure. So I want to keep on your progression track. We're going to move up the years, but I'm going to sort of jump to the end here probably and ask if all of that breadth of practice and then all the years so far has led you to narrow down to specific sports, shall we say? Like, this is the list of stuff that's good and I would bother with at this point. Or is it still just accumulative of taking pieces from all of those things that you listed? If I'm going, hey, I want to learn self-defense, eventually I want to teach self-defense, how are you going to frame that in terms of all of those available tool sets?
I would definitely simplify and boil it down to, understanding some really functional striking, be it Muay Thai or boxing, and then understand how to clinch fight. And that could be from Greco, from wrestling, from Muay Thai, all that stuff, just understanding the clinch, because that's a huge thing. Because, the saying, all fights go to the ground. I've had a lot that didn't. But a lot of them, almost all of them at some point got into a clinch scenario where I had to clinch up. All right. So, and then I had the opportunity, whether I brought it to the ground or pushed the person back or just controlled them there. So having that ability to fight in a clinch is really important. And then of course I would have, you know, I have to put in jujitsu. When I say jujitsu, I always, to me, it's gi, no gi. You have to know, you have to have a clue of both. Because, you know, everybody who loves the no-gi, that's awesome and it's super important. But we live in an environment for where a lot of the year we wear coats and a lot of clothes. And so having that ability to at least grab, be able to grab the clothes, regardless if you're going to do a technique or not, you understand how to control their arms and mitigate the damage that they can do to you. And then understanding how to use that against them in sweeps and other types of things that can reverse the fight really fast, I think is an invaluable skill. Now, on the other hand, if all you're used to doing is gripping that gi and a guy doesn't have one on and he's crazy, he's wild, and he's strong as crap, it gets really dicey really fast. So now understanding how to grab the neck and the elbows and where to put your hands to stop the punches from coming with the no-gi. And, you know, adding that element of, you know, I want to know what's going to happen if someone punches me and how to tie up their arms. I think that's why I'd boil it down.
The first and mostly only time I ever rolled with strikes, which is like friendly taps with padded, you know, knuckles, was a gigantic eye opener. Because I'm sitting there comfortable and in half guard like I do. And you just tap, tap. Tap, yep. Tap, tap. And I'm like, oh, shit.
Yes. So it really changes things. And then right now we do a lot of grappling with the firearm because, once again, 86% of the times are simple assault. So you're not going to have that thing in. But if someone finds out that you have a gun, they fixate on the gun and they go nuts and they try to get it. And now your defense and everything shifts from, oh, I got to watch out for arm bars and neck cranks and chokes. No, you have your defense boils down to, I got to protect what's on my hip with everything I have.
And that's way different.
It's a way different game.
I've trained with Todd quite a bit, and I'm the biggest, scariest looking dude in that room. And I was probably the most scared in the training sessions I've done because it's like, man, I am not protecting this weapon here as well.
And it comes out really fast.
Yep, pops right out.
And it becomes a new art. It's a completely different art. And I found, for me personally, we used to grapple a lot with a knife as well. You know, so we had a good understanding of how to protect it, but it's a lot harder to get to a knife. That's a little teeny thing. A gun is like basically a handle that's on your hip. And so when I started really focusing on grappling with the gun, my entire defense, gi and no gi, elevated to another level. Because now my elbows were constantly tighter. It was like I was going back in time. Because when we first started jujitsu with, my first private in jujitsu with a Gracie was Hicks and Gracie in 1990. And his system was very straightforward, very simple, wrapped in probably one of the most athletic, strong, gorilla-like human beings on the planet. And so it's like, he was very adamant on elbows here, do this, just move your hips, blah, blah, blah. And you do it, but then he would do it. And it's like, why does he do it? And it feels like a 400-pound gorilla doing it to me. And I'm doing it. It feels like I'm like a little fairy flipping around. He's flittering me off. It's like, what is going on here? And he goes, and so I remember this kind of fun story that we were just working the mount, how to hold the mount and how to get away from the mount. And so got done with that, learned a lot with a very few things that I still do to this day. It was just so impactful to me about holding and controlling mount and escaping mount. And then we worked, okay, I am going to show you the mateleo to kill the lions. the rear naked choke. And I'm like, oh, cool. Yeah, yeah, I know how to do this. He goes, okay, what we're going to do is I'm going to have you put the choke on me. And if you can make me say uncle, you can have the private and the next one for free. I'm like, oh, yeah. Here you go. And he puts his neck super long and he turns around. And he goes, my friend, I cannot make my neck any longer. And so I wrapped it on and I started, and I was like, okay, I'm getting a free private. And I started squeezing. And all of a sudden I heard the, he started doing his breathing. Next thing I know, somehow he's doing like the, you know, Lethal Weapon, get out of straitjacket thing. And his shoulder's coming up. Also, my arm's not around his neck anymore. All of a sudden, I'm off his neck. All of a sudden, I'm in front of him, and he chokes me in a split second like my head was going to fly off like a water rocket. And he looks at me, and he goes, it is obvious that you have read a magazine or watched a video, because you do not understand the leverage of the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. And I'm like, I don't know what just happened. But it was the coolest thing in the world.
I'll pay double for the next one.
And so that was this huge eye-opening experience, because 1989, I just got done doing, you know, getting done with a lot of wrestling, you know, through the 80s. And so you're pretty competitive, young, doing judo. So you're feeling pretty good about yourself. And then you're walking out going, whoa, I don't really know much. This is crazy. And he didn't do hardly anything. And Eric was working in Horion's garage at the time, Eric Paulson. Mm-hmm. So I was doing stuff in like 89. We were doing privates in Eric's garage, and we're doing purely like defensive Gracie Jiu-Jitsu. And he's showing me all the basics, and we got videos of it. It's super cool when we look back and we're like, man, we were really doing stuff like in 1989. It's still being done today as far as the combatives go. So it was really, we had kind of a head start by far on a lot of people. Then when I moved back here, and I also went out in 94, that's when I met Professor Sauer. And before that, I met Cesar Gracie and right at the same time, Henzo. So I was meeting all these different people. And I met Professor Sauer in 1994 at Frank Cucci's school in Virginia Beach. He's an ex-SEAL Team 6 guy, and he has martial arts school. And so I'd go out there, and I'd go, wow, Professor Sauer's a little different. I mean, he's so detailed, but every time you ask him a question, he wouldn't show me. He'd go, let me feel it. And I'd try something, and he'd go, oh, okay. It wasn't like, oh, here's what you can do. Here's step 1, 2, 3. It's like, no, let me feel.
Let me exploit what's missing for you.
And then he would show a move, and then he would go around to each individual, and he'd say, okay, you're taller. You have to do this. You're short. You can take out steps. You're this. So he was able to modify it for the people around him, and it wasn't this cookie cutter thing. It was an individual expression of jiu-jitsu at what I saw as like the kind of the highest level, really focus on the details and technique, which was really cool, because Sensei Yuri Nakamura, our shudo instructor, was super detailed on how to attack the heels, the Achilles locks, how to lock things up immediately, how to take the little twist of your forearm so it's completely bone on bone at the right angle to attack. And so it was like, he was more brutal with it, and Professor was more subtle with it, but it was just that same mentality of being precise and being really focused on the mechanics of your body and how they work and how can you work with your body so you're not fighting yourself, because you already got a problem in front of you fighting you. Why fight two people? Let's figure out how to move your body so it's so efficient that you just got to deal with the problem in front of you. And which for me, like I said, really resonated, because I was also an All-American gymnast, which is about what? Perfecting motion and movement. And being really subtle and having this awareness of where your body is. And so all these things kind of just were with the fight experience and everything else. Right. Is this all coming together in this perfect orb of martial art, fighting, technical precision, brutality and loving it all and absolutely loving every second of it.
Yeah. Was the precision and individualized style coaching any kind of a contrast to like Hickson? Like, was that a little bit more, here's how you do it, go do it?
Well, the unique thing about Hickson is he was the lion of the family. So he had to take on all the fights and all the things. And so he has this room, and Eric Paulson's been there. He talks about it, but he has like tapes of like every fighting style you could possibly imagine. And you'd study him to see how he'd move and how to counter him. So it wasn't like he had the move that was going to work against everybody. It's like, no, you got to be able to adapt. You have to be able to, but the concepts of framing and using your hips and understanding how to, you know, off balance the person and weight distribution and using your body as an anchor, you know, all these things and finding the connection points. That's what he was really universally teaching. Things that wouldn't matter what you were doing. Boom.
Regardless of the sport or the label, it's just the movements and positions.
Yes. And there's, you know, functionally, how many ways are you going to make a good frame? Not a lot.
Right.
Either it's a good frame or it's not. You find out really quick. And so it's about finding that ability to quickly find that position where you can frame out really fast and create connections. And I got the concept of the connections from Professor Sauer, who was directly with under Helio and Hickson. And he was all about, you have to find a connection because otherwise you can't feel what the person's doing. And without feeling, it's fantasy. You could do all the step 1, 2, 3, 4s in the world and it's not going to work because problem is the guy that you're going against doesn't know your step 1, 2, 3, 4. He's doing some other stuff. So, but the connection allows you to, okay, now I can wait for an opportunity to find that. Oh, there's my next little movement that I have to do, my hip movement, which now allows me to get a frame in with my leg, which now makes more opportunity to create a little bit more space, which now gives me more room. And so it was those concepts and principles that I found in wrestling, I found in Wing Chun, I found in jiu-jitsu, I found in shudo, you name the art, they were there.
Elbow bends this way and bends back.
Yeah.
Change the angle that you do it at a little bit, and that's about it.
And doing the other arts, all these other arts, what that did more than anything, it kind of spurred this creativity, this ability to look for things and find things and see how it was going to fit and if it was going to fit and what would I have to do? How would I have to modify it to make it fit? And did I modify it or did I just find its original source in the beginning that was lost in dogma? You know, it's like really kind of a cool exploration in movement. And if you look at Filipino martial arts, one of the ways people look at the word Kali, it's like an acronym, K-A-L-I, Katawan Lihok, Kamut Lihok. Katawan Lihok means body motion. Kamut Lihok means hand motion. So there it's going, oh, we're just trying to figure out how to navigate through the movement. And it didn't matter if you had a stick in your hand, no stick in your hand, a sword in your hand. It's the same movement. We counter it with very similar things. We don't have to think, oh, it's stick. It's an empty hand. It's a knife. We got to do different things for all of it. It's about finding the most effective thing first and then becoming more efficient with it. Because efficiency without effectiveness is just a quick way to get beat up.
And then adding different techniques, if that doesn't work, then you look elsewhere.
Yes. Yeah. And then you have the ability to adapt and quickly modify what you're doing. And basically now you're now in the realm of feel and flow. Feel and flow and things that you have and being and having a really creative and fun environment to do that. I think that's another huge aspect of coming up how we did. There were so many drills that we're doing that were with the weapon, with you know, striking, with grappling, and they're all geared towards competitive fighting of some nature, right? So the goal was, how do we find these partners that we could bring it closer and closer to that combative edge, but still be able to walk home that day with all our fingers. Yeah. And
got to go to work in the morning.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And that enabled us to really get creative because we had this opportunity to work with people that you trusted and you could try things. And if it didn't work, you knew all you'd have to do is tap and you're good to go. Or you didn't have to worry about getting killed, but you still had a really tough guy in front of you that was going to put you to the test.
Yeah, make you work for it.
Make you work for it.
Not to further distract from the timeline explanation, mm-hmm. but do you think, like we're, what are we, 30 years post UFC 1 roughly at this point, or maybe a little bit closer to
1993.
Yeah, something like that. And it seems like the impression people would have is boxing, Muay Thai, Jiu-Jitsu, wrestling, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's a disservice to those of us trying to learn the martial arts now that the consensus in a way is like those are the things you need to learn and it's trickier to stumble into Wing Chun, trickier to stumble into Kali?
I mean, it's definitely is trickier to stumble into those things because they're not out there as much.
Yeah.
How, you know, but in my case, I always look at it like this. What are you doing it for ultimately? Because nobody I fought with in the Target parking lot knew Muay Thai or wrestling or Kali or Wing Chun or anything.
Yeah.
They were just dudes swinging fists.
Mm-hmm.
And if I tried to fight him like a Thai boxer, I probably would have got hit a lot more and some crazy stuff happened if I tried to wrestle him like a wrestler. But no, I was just fighting him. And everything kind of just, it's a different world because they don't move like the person who's been programmed to move a certain way because you've trained jiu-jitsu for a while or you've done Muay Thai or you've boxed or you've done whatever. What I always say is that boxers do really well against other boxers, not so good against wrestlers. Wrestlers naturally do really good against this, but when you add a different element, it takes away. So it's like, for me, it's like finding that, you know, what do I want to do it for? Like Todd Fossey, he wants to do it for one reason, how to retain my gun and be able to control the situation.
And get the hell out of there.
Get the hell out of there.
Yeah.
And conceal this as much as possible. Never get, and if it has to come out, I have to do it in a way that is 100% justified, 100%, you know, in a way that's not going to get me in more trouble and potentially killed and the people I'm with killed. And so he doesn't have any kind of fantasy about, oh, does it work in Octagon? I don't really care.
Yeah.
He doesn't care. He's about that element of the self-defense block. And for me, that's what, you know, I always ask people, I mean, what do you want to do this for? Well, I want to do it for self-defense. Okay, cool. And then they're like, oh, yeah, I don't like grappling with that guy because he's really spazzy. I go, that's the dude you want to grapple.
Yes.
Because he doesn't move like everyone else. He's a goof. He's a spaz, and he's strong.
The guy looking to snag your car keys out of your hand is going to move like a spaz. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. I go, if you're doing self-defense, get over that fear and figure out how to just stop him from being crazy enough that he slows down. And now he can start to find your game. I go, don't. That's what you want to do. So now if you're doing it for fighting and you're, I mean, it could be, you have to look at it. Am I doing it for ADCC rule base? Or am I doing it for IBJJF? You know, am I doing it for this rule base? Am I doing it with strikes? Am I doing open hand strikes? Am I doing it? I mean, or what I look at is if there's a bunch of moves, if I have moves, techniques, concepts that will work in an IBJJF total rules format, it'll work no-gi in different rules format. It'll work in MMA, and it works on the street. I go, to me, those are my A-game moves because I don't have to think. They'll work on all of them. I don't have to think about, dang it, I twist the heel, I reaped. I mean, I'm banned forever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Forgot where I was for a second. Yeah, now we're gone.
So it's like, dang it. So my thing is if I have a set of things that I do that crosses all those lines, to me, that's a major focus point of my training. I don't have to think. Even when I grapple out on with the gi, without the gi, the way I put my hands, I'm always thinking, if he was to punch me right now, where would my hands be? I don't put them back here and try to, I'm just not, because my focus is, you know, I want to do the jujitsu, but if they could punch me, they could probably grab my collar. If they can grab my collar, they can probably punch me. So if I can stop both those from happening, well, that's a big part of the game. They don't have control over my neck and my head, and they're not punching my head and my neck. Doesn't matter if I'm, what rule base I'm in. It's crossing board. So I look for things like that. And, you know, even when I'm, like I said, I'm grappling, my hands are always monitoring where the hands are, where their arms are. Because I'm always thinking, if I'm playing to guard, we do so much fighting here, and so much MMA, and I have such a background in fighting for real. Like, when stuff goes crazy, I've been stabbed twice. You know, I mean, just things happen real fast, and you don't see it. And so I want to know where those hands are all the time. And if I know where their hands are, it's going to be a lot harder for them to submit me. It's going to be a lot harder for them to hit me. It's going to be a lot harder for them to control me. So then I can start. Now I can do whatever I'm going to do, whether it's in the gi, whether it's no gi, whether it's, you know, MMA, or whether I'm thinking firearm and fighting. So that's where my mindset goes. So I can play, but I'm really big into encouraging people to be creative. I mean, in the gi, that's probably the most creative area we have. I don't have to worry about getting punched in the face. I got the gi. I can grab the sleeves. I can wrap my legs over it. I can grab different parts of the gi. I can grab their belt. I can make up stuff. What do you think is happening all the time? People are stumbling across things and they go, wait a minute. This is kind of cool. How much did that control you? That really controlled me. What were you doing? Not sure. Let's figure it out. Next thing you know, you got whatever kind of guard.
Right.
Or you have this type of technique.
Slug guard or something. Yeah, exactly. Something silly. Yeah.
Now, if you look at, you know, MMA, there's some guys that can do some creative things, but generally, it's the same stuff that's been happening for the last 10 years.
The template is set.
You can't get too creative with a cool sweep when they're punching your face and elbowing your teeth out. You have to monitor that constantly. So, yeah, it, and I always say the higher the risk, the simpler things got to be, right? But I'm also a complete martial artist. You know, I always tell people, well, what do you do? Do you do MMA? And I go, no, I go TMMA. And they go, what's that? Total mixed martial arts. I do it with weaponry. I do it with sticks. I do it with, with cloth. I do it with whatever I can.
MMA. Is its own specific thing now, with its tighter limitations than it had the first couple years and that it would have in real life. So
when we first started fighting out of the academy, no gloves, you could headbutt, you could hair pull, you could hit the groin. You just couldn't bite, gouge the eyes. I mean, it was closer to no holds barred, which it was called.
Yes.
There was still holds barred for sure, but it was a lot closer. Then I think they realized people are going to die.
Yeah.
Someone's going to get mounted, because we had guys who mounted people, held their hands like in a schoolyard and headbutted them and just knocked them out and then punched them like 10 times in the face. And they're like, oh my God, that guy was out before he was getting hit.
Right.
So it's like, let's take the headbutts out. Okay. Let's take the hair pulling out. Let's take, you know, so it changed things. Now you have one FC, which now you can knee on the ground again. You can still elbow. And that, the knee on the ground changes things entirely.
Closer to an honest fight, though,
yes,
right?
Yeah. Yes. And now we have bare knuckle fighting again, like Mike Richmond fights out of here, bare knuckle.
Yep.
And it's a different world because your hands aren't protected like they are when you're taped up and then you have a set of gloves on. You can slug differently and punch differently, make little mistakes with your hits. You still get your hand broke,
right?
But now you have no protection on your hands and you're slugging people in their bowling ball. And a lot of hands get messed up. When Mike gets done with a fight, his hands are swollen. His face is swollen, right? It's a different, and you hear every shot land. It's like a, you hear that crack land, and it's a different world. And people are like, oh my God, what's that like? I go, oh, it's like what it used to be like. Yeah, that's how we started. It was
back when men were men. Yeah, God damn it.
And nobody got paid. It was just like, yeah, I want to fight because I want to see how tough I am. How much you getting? I paid $86 to enter the tournament, and we busting down to Iowa.
Yeah, I broke my hand.
Yeah, exactly. But it was that was the evolution of it.
You said when we first started training at the academy. When was that?
Well, I started training first with Rick Fay in 1983 in his garage.
Yeah.
And then in 1992 is when I started the academy.
Okay. So you'd already started the academy when you're bouncing around training with other people, yes, going to Hickson, whatever.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So in 1992, that's when I formally opened the academy. It was first called the Minnesota Martial Arts Academy. Mm-hmm. And then when mixed martial arts came, we had the moniker MMAA. And then it became MMMAA. And I go, what's the other M for? Well, it's Minnesota Mixed Martial Arts Academy. And I go, no.
It's too much.
Too much. And everybody always called us the Academy. Oh, you train at the Academy? So I just, our corporation, S-Corp, is still Minnesota Martial Arts Incorporated. Mm-hmm. But it's just the Academy, and everybody knows the Academy.
Yeah, yeah. So which space is that? Because you've had a couple different spots.
Yeah, we had the first one was on the other side of Highway 100 on 57th Avenue in Brooklyn Center.
So in the neighborhood still here?
Yeah, in the neighborhood. Yeah. And then we just, what happened is it was a kind of a dilapidated shopping mall. Just
I've heard.
Yeah.
Rocco and a few other people, I think, went back that far. So.
Yes, yes. And so it was like a dilapidated mall that went into eminent domain.
Mm.
So I had to find a new spot. But lo and behold, I didn't know that Brooklyn Center is going to give me money to do that. You know, yeah, I didn't know that.
Silver lining.
Yeah. Yes. So we went around, and all of a sudden we found the warehouse. And I'm like, why in the hell didn't I do this like 10 years ago? But you get familiar, you get comfortable in where you're at. And so we moved here and into this space, and it only had this first side. We didn't have the second side.
Sure.
And then we eventually opened up the second side. We had it with a fitness company that did half their stuff in there. Then we ended up just taking the whole thing over.
How many total years in business?
That was 2003 that we opened here, but okay. I opened up 92 to now.
Very nice. I was graduating high school in 2003.
Yeah.
who are you training under, like mid 90s forward? Let's say, like, once you've got your first space in place, like what is like the lineage for the various things?
Rick Fay is my first instructor, my first real formal instructor. And immediately in 1984 is when I met Guru Dan Inosanto.
Yeah.
I met Achan Chai. And then I met probably shortly thereafter, Larry Hartzell, Sifu Larry Hartzell, Tim Tackett, Sifu Francis Fong. In Wing Chun. Then shortly after, and then Hickson was in there, met Hickson, but that I wasn't formally trained. I just got a few privates with him.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up with Eric Paulson, so Eric Paulson was major influence because we trained all the time together. Then I met Nikolai Sagnol, who's my Savat instructor. Salem Asley, who's my Savat instructor. So it was with them as well. And then Yuri Nakamura was in 1990. Yeah, 1990 when he came out. And he was training at the Inosanto Academy because he was absolutely in love with Jeet Kune Do and Bruce Lee. And the first time I went out there, I just... was this at a training trip. It was like 1989 when I met him. It's, oh, this is a Yuri Nakamura from Japan. Like, oh, cool. He's here to learn Jun Fan and Jeet Kune Do. He's, you know, his martial arts. Oh, great. Well, all of a sudden he comes up to Guru Dan one day and he goes, Guru, I have something that you might like. It's called shooter wrestling. Shooto. He goes, oh, what's that? And that's when Shudo came. He was the whole time sitting there, but he thought, oh, Guru Dan already knows all this stuff, you know? And he's like, why didn't you tell me this like 8 months ago? Oh.
Figured you knew.
Yeah, I figured you know. And so he was the 1986 champion of Japan in Shudo. And so he was originally under Satoru Sayama, Carl Gotch, Victor Toga, the six-time world combo sambo champion, and Toshio Fujiwara, who was the first Japanese to win a major title in a major stadium in Thailand. And so those guys all got together and created Shudo. And so all of a sudden I went out there in 1990, and there were Shudo classes. And when I was there every day training with Yuri, it was just like, this is it. We're punching, we're kicking, we're kneeing, we're doing takedowns, we're doing submissions, we're hitting on the ground. And that, it, you know, they were fighting in Japan like that in the ring, and like you see now almost in those rules, starting in 1986, and you watch some of those fights, or 85, I think, and you watch some of those fights, and you're watching going, geez, these guys are at a super high level. I mean, how they were moving. It's like the fighters now. And that was the really the kind of the beginning of like MMA for us, because now we were able to, you know, fight. And then we fought. I fought in the Shudo fights in LA, 1994, and so that was just a blast. We'd all get together and all Guru Dan and Asanta would be there, and Achan Chai and Yuri and all of our instructors, and we're in there fighting. I fought Ron Balicki my first fight, you know, out there, and he's under Guru Dan and Asanta, and under all the instructors, we're all under each other, right? So we all know each other, and we get in there, and we just scrap, and it's just like, yes, we're here.
Well, and you can tell there's probably magic to it, just because it was like pre-internet, pre-social media, like. This is a grand affair that we're all here,
yes.
Regardless of what happens,
yep.
And who wins and whatever.
Oh, is this a blast?
Kind of a throwback to a different time thing.
Yeah.
The reason I ask, like, who your lineages were, like, who your instructors were, one, because you listed off all those things in the beginning here, mm-hmm. The 39 different styles that you've studied or whatever, but two, because you're kind of the guy in the conversation now for Minnesota, at least. Like the lineage conversations in a way lead back to Greg, and that's like sort of it, just because that's the way history works out, gets kind of more and more washed down.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, give me the names.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the list of names we all need to go Google and learn the real lineage. Yeah, much like how you said that, you know, if you saw the footage from those tournaments in the 80s in Japan, it's pretty much the origin of MMA as we know it, but that's 10, 12, 15 years before the origin of MMA, yes. That we know.
Yes.
Like there's the start, and then there's the real start to so many things.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fun. And then when you watch, when you go back and watch the Vale Tudo fights and how, you know, again, that was just another crazy time where they were just, there was a lot of rivalries. That was like fights being done for real in there.
Sharks and Jets.
Yes, exactly. But it all shaped what we're doing now, in for sure. And it gave our original instructors, like Professor Peter Sauer, because he's back in the times where people were challenging and coming into your dojo bashing and trying, yeah, to fight and coming in. And so there was a funk. And, you know, Professor Peter Sauer, before he did jiu-jitsu, he was a kickboxer. He trained with Marco Huas in the same school, and he grew up with Hickson, but he's, you know, I'm doing this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, you should come in and do jiu-jitsu. No, I'm doing, you know, my striking.
Sure.
And then when he went in that one time, and Hoyler, who was like 9, choked him out like 3 times, and he's like, what the heck just happened? I got choked out by this kid that I know from, yeah, the neighborhood.
Right.
And that's when he totally switched and went to jiu-jitsu.
Sure. Violence is indeed the answer sometimes.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep.
So when do you get your black belt in jiu-jitsu?
I got my black belt in 2000, 2002.
So how many total years is that, just out of curiosity?
But now we got 2024, so that's
whatever the quick math is. Now,
22 years ago.
Who are you belted under? Is it all Pedro?
Yep, from white belt all the way up to all my stripes. It's been Professor Sauer.
And I hear stories of needing to go out to see him for ceremony in order to belt up. Is that the case back then?
Yeah, I mean, I went out to his original schools in Salt Lake City. I went out there when we first started. I got when we were testing for blue belt. And then he would come here. But yeah, we'd go out there for a week at a time and train and then come back and then go back out and come back. And that was like it was a super fun time. You know, again, everything's so new and you're just like, man, this is it.
Yeah.
We found it.
Well, it's also a dramatically different experience than like what I would have. Like I joined M Theory. I train at M Theory. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, I will belt up at some point again at M Theory, and the dude's going to hand it to me because we just rolled and he watches me drill, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
But like back then, you come home and workshop it with your buddies, and then next time you see him, hopefully you demonstrate what you learned the last time you saw him. Or what's the mechanics of learning in that way?
Yeah, back with Professor Sauer, especially the blue belt. The purple belt is a little bit different test for sure. But the blue belt, he had a specific number of moves that he wanted you to demonstrate. And then also a lot of live grappling. So you demonstrate all your moves, but you
prove it.
Yeah, now you got to grapple.
Yeah.
You got to grapple and put it on the line. And so that was a big thing. So I was always focused on being as technical as I could be. So I'd really focus on developing and drilling and trying to clean up my mechanics as much as possible. But my rolling was, you know, a lot of times completely different because you have so many years of competitive fighting and rolling and no-gi and gi and wrestling. And so my rolling style would be a lot of kind of that wrestling pressure involved in it. But then I also have this, and it's so funny because everything comes back into all this stuff I've done. So people are like, how can you just stick to my hands? I can't do anything with my arms. I go, oh, that's probably like 20 years of Chi Sao from Wing Chun, where you're just moving around like this, and Hu Bud. So I do a lot of stuff where I'm just monitoring hands and I can stick with it. I don't have to grab it. I can just follow it. Meanwhile, my other hand's grabbing over here and this one's doing this. And they go, well, how'd you develop that? And I go, yeah, it's just all this other training.
Right. Fuck the 10,000 hour rule. It's 100,000 hours of practicing hand fighting.
Yeah, of hand fighting and even in wrestling, and you're sticking to those hands and you're monitoring. And so this when I'd roll, it would be definitely a little bit different than the technical application. But because of doing that, you understand your mechanics better and where to move. But what I think it really helps me with is being able to teach a lot of different types of people. You have the super gifted athlete who's comes in with some, you know, very functional fighting skill. I can teach him a lot differently than the person who's done nothing and is absolutely terrified when they're walking in off the mat. Now it's like, okay, now here's where we're going to start here. And I can take this guy and I go, okay, hold him down. That's all I get. You just got to get away. Let's see what happens. And then you go, oh, okay, let's do this now. Put your hand here. Now go. Totally different world.
Right. Just fill small gaps along the way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Whereas the person who had maybe never done anything athletic in their life and they're really timid, you have to, develop them in a different way or else they're not going to last. They're going to be gone. You know, they're not used to failing. They're not used to getting submitted. Now it's just like, geez, this is just me getting beat up by my brother again. I'm out. Mm-hmm. You know, so now let's do this a little bit. We can, or let's say someone comes in. I have one of he's a black belt now, and he was a karate guy back in the day. I mean, back in the blood and guts era of karate. And, but he's a two-time Purple Heart winner, Vietnam War, got shot once, shrapnel another time, broke his neck, got his arm shattered as a law enforcement officer, so he has all his nerve damage, can't move very well. And I remember he came in for his first class, and I wasn't teaching it, but one of the other instructors was, and he's like, I don't think I can do it. He was doing like inverted guard and rolling. I can't do this stuff. Can't do it. There's like my neck is, I can't. I go, no. Why don't you come back and let me work with you? And this is after my cancer too. So I had to relearn how to walk, and I had to relearn how to do everything all over again because I didn't have the same athleticism as I had before. So I started finding all these cheat codes to moves. Hmm. Before I could go, yeah, and I'd be somewhere.
Right.
Now it was like,
that sound feels more familiar.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I just became the guy I used to make fun of.
Right.
Oh, no. But I figured out because my feet, I remember I came back on the mat the first time I got back on the mat after my cancer, and I was just going to do some hip movements, some shrimps down the mat. And I went, and guess what happened? My feet slid off the mat. My body didn't move. And I go, oh, no, I'm that guy.
The most fundamental, yes, basic thing.
And I had to figure it out. So here's a guy that now came to me who had all these ailments. And I go, I have some tricks I think will work for you. And he stayed for 10 years and got his black belt and worked through it. Now, is he going to move like, you know, a wrestler that comes in? No. But he was there all the time. He's working. He's both shoulders replaced. Hand doesn't work. Broken neck. Diabetes. I mean, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
Agent Orange. Yeah, you know, it has all these things. And so, but he gets on the mat. He's able to move. He's shrimping. He's doing all this stuff. And it's like, and for him, he said it changed his life. He lost all his confidence, and all of a sudden he got confidence back. He could move. When he first came back, it was almost like the confidence was shattered again because I can't do this. I can't do this now. And say, like, no. What's work?
He had accepted the constraints, accepted the limitations. So bumping into something that showed him those constraints again kind of killed him for a second.
Yeah. And so I said, no, let's do this a different way. And so I was able to work with him. And it really was because I had to go through that now.
Yeah.
And if I didn't experience that part of the game, I probably would have went, I don't know if he can do this sentence. I mean, I don't know. I probably wouldn't have been like that. But,
right,
you know, I wouldn't have had a lot of different drills and ways to, you know, make incremental movements as opposed to, okay, this is the drill. We just got to do this until you figure it out.
Certainly not a ready-made game plan.
Yeah.
Like, it sounds like you were watching him going, okay, I got some ideas. Why don't you come back?
Yes.
Right then and there.
And that, you know, that's another element of the story I would have to say is it's training and my martial arts pre-cancer, post-cancer.
When was the first one? You were twice through that bullshit, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Give me the breakdown of that.
2001 is when I was diagnosed with stage 4 liver cancer. So I had two tumors on my liver, one on my spleen. I had spots on my kidney, and they basically said, "Get your affairs in order."
Yeah.
But I didn't hear that. I didn't want to hear that stuff. I said, "Don't tell me any of that stuff. Just tell me what I need to do." And as long as, because leading up to it, I didn't know what was going on. I just was just getting super tired, couldn't do anything, was taking naps and sleeping in the middle of the day, which I never did.
Right.
And
creeps up on you.
Yeah. And so they got misdiagnosed a bunch of times. And then finally, I ended up going in for a CAT scan. And they said, head down to North Memorial. And I remember that was the first time when I got off the elevator and opened up and saw oncology. Mm. I go, oh, I must have cancer. Huh. And then we went in there and then they did a biopsy of my liver and they said, okay, here's the deal. But in my mindset, it was like, finally, I know who to fight now. Not knowing was way worse in my mind.
Right, right.
It's like, okay, here's what we got. We got this new opponent. And it was go for it. And everything kind of came back into the martial arts, everything I've experienced. It's like when I started in with chemo, you lose weight and it's just and you get super tired. It's like your hardest workout that you never recover from. You can't recover from. You're just exhausted. And I go, but my mindset was like, well, I've been really tired before. Is this longer?
Mm-hmm.
But I know what this feels like. Oh, I've cut weight. I've cut a lot of weight before. That's what's happened. I'm down my wrestling weight again.
Yeah.
I cut weight before.
It's the value of doing hard things for the sake of doing hard things.
Exactly. And so everything, and even when I was in the second one, I did 6 months of chemo, went into remission. So they thought.
Right.
And then I started getting all this pain in my legs and it was drifting down. I started losing the ability to use my legs. I would fall down, I'd trip. The pain was off the charts.
Needing naps is one thing, but falling down, that's a different.
And then I went down to Rochester Mayo. They didn't know what was going on. They'd taken all these tests. But at that point, I was down there primarily because I was referred by my doctors up here because there was so much pain. I had a little fanny pack on that would every 15 minutes shoot morphine into my body because it was just nonstop.
Jesus.
And because it was just so bad. And then that would start to fail. So I'd have to go in and have to hit Dilaudid, put me in ICU. And it was just dealing with pain. Well, finally, I got admitted down into, they have St. Mary's and Methodist Hospital are attached to Mayo. And so when I went in through the emergency room, I did not leave for 5 months. 5 months I was bobbling in between those two hospitals as they're trying to figure out what this pain is coming from.
So you show up to the emergency room and go, man, I'm in a lot of pain. And you don't leave for half a year.
Yep. And what has happened is they had to, they were trying to at first just deal with the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, 24/7 morphine. And then all of a sudden my heart rate would go down to 20s. I'd stop breathing. And so then they would have to, induce me, so I'd be out. I'd be on 48-hour ketamine drips. Then they'd reintroduce the morphine. But they're like, we don't know what's going on here. And it's like, most people would be dying from the pain, or it would be very easy because when you stop breathing, you don't feel it. You just stop breathing. The only thing that kept going was, this alarm would go off and the nurse would wheel her chair back and go, you got to breathe. And then you'd physically go and have to breathe. You'd have to fight. You'd have to make yourself breathe.
That's fucking wild.
Yeah, so it was like crazy, right? And then they finally were doing thing after thing, and they finally did this high-powered MRI imaging, which they just had developed, and they found that my left sciatic nerve was bigger and brighter than my right. And then they went in, they biopsied first my serial nerve on my leg, because this leg was all from the bottom of my feet all the way up, just like it was on fire. And if you touched my skin, it was like you were being filleted by a razor. It was just, everything was just off the chart pain. So they biopsied that. They couldn't find anything. So then they biopsied my sciatic nerve, which was a huge undertaking because they got to figure out what's a motor nerve, what's a,
sensory nerve. Yeah.
And so they can pluck the sensory nerves, but if you accidentally pluck the wrong motor nerve, and they said, well, if we do this, it's a pretty extensive thing. You may not walk again. I'm like, I don't walk now. I just want to see my kids grow up. I'll play murder ball.
Right.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not giving up the fight. I just want to see the kids grow up. Well, they did that, and they found that the lymphoma had drifted into my sciatic nervous system. So it was in my corpus quinus and my sciatic nerve. So I had cancer of the nervous system.
What the fuck?
So they said, once again, I said, I don't want to hear stats or numbers.
Right.
But at this point in time, they said they had seen 33 known cases of this. 32 they found postmortem, and the 33rd person died. But I didn't hear the numbers.
That's why you tell them not to tell you the stats. Yes. Jesus.
So I said, okay, what do we got to do? And they said, well, we have one thing that we're going to try. And this was 2002. Early 2003, when I had my full body stem cell transplant, which was a pretty new thing at the time. So they were able to take,
heard of that.
Yeah. So they were able to take my stem cells out of my blood because it was in my nervous system. It wasn't in my blood. So they took out whatever at that point, which is a pretty small number now comparatively to how they do the stem cells now, but it was like 5 million stem cells they were able to get in 3 days. And then they just bombard you with chemo to just destroy everything. And the first chemo didn't work. Second chemo didn't work. So they had this Dr. Ritzig. He's like the chemo concoctionist guy, and he kind of put it together. And it finally worked. And then after that, then they just reintroduce all these stem cells back into your body. And they said, well, it's kind of like this. We had the blue screen on your computer, and we kind of fixed it. And if we put the on button and it's still blue, it's over. We don't have anything else. If the computer goes on, we're good. And that's what it was. And so I got this full body stem cell transplant. And that 4-5 months I was in Mayo, probably 4 months of it, I was like an invalid. Couldn't move my legs, couldn't walk, couldn't do anything.
Oof.
In 7 days, I was up on a walker after the full body stem cell transplant.
Whoa.
The pain was greatly diminished. It was still there because there was nerve damage, but I was now doing therapy and was now learning how to walk, which was about a year-long experience to learn how to walk again. And so it was like 3 months with a walker, and then I had a cane, and then had the cane for quite a while. And to this day, I still have a drop foot because my left foot I can't flex it back. So people go, what do you mean you can't flex your foot back? How do you do hooks? I go, I haven't done a hook on my left leg, on the left side, since 2003. Really? I can't ever feel that? And I go, yeah. Jean-Jacques Machado said, you don't modify for jiu-jitsu. Jiu-jitsu modifies for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it, And that it was a huge thing. You figure out how to work around things.
Especially when you don't have a choice.
Yeah, you don't have a choice. You better figure it out, or it is what it is.
Everybody's going to pass to that side.
Yes. So you have to figure out how to do different hooks, different things. And so it definitely changed my game. It gave me a lot of different ways to move, because learning how to walk, well, then, of course, I had to learn how to do all the things that I could do without a thought. I now had to physically and mentally figure out how to do them again.
Right.
And because on my bottom of my left foot and bottom of my right foot, I didn't really have sensory nerves that were working. So if I stand on my left foot, how you just, without a thought, your body does its thing.
Yep.
Well, mine just sits there, and I have to move my upper body to try to balance on a peg that's like this, because my toes won't grip, they won't move.
You're not getting the feedback.
Getting feedback.
Wow.
So learning how to kick, learning how to do everything that was about footwork and movement and wrestling and everything. Had to learn it all over again in a slightly different way. You had the fundamental understandings of how they work, the principles.
It's an informed rebuild, but it's a rebuild.
It's a rebuild.
How long did that take? Like, what do you think, rough estimate in terms of like back to being like, okay, I can handle myself out here again?
I mean, it was weird. Like, coach, I can't remember half the stuff because I was still on a bunch of pain meds.
Sure.
But Coach Nat remembers, I come back, I couldn't even hardly walk on the mat, and people were trying to do stuff. And my upper body never lost its ability to do things, right? And so they would be trying to pass, but my legs are basically just limp noodles down there. And they're trying to get to a position of control, and they couldn't. And I was still able to do things. They go, what are you doing? How are you able to do this without legs? I go, I don't know. I'm using my arms.
Yeah.
I mean, there were
four limbs.
Yeah. And so what was funny was all those things from hand fighting and wrestling and Wing Chun and the Filipino martial arts and all the trapping and all that stuff that was already in there never left. So that was there. And it basically enabled me to be able to grapple on the ground. And slowly but surely, my right leg was the first one to come into play. And then my left leg would be coming into play. My right leg I could hook with, my left leg I couldn't. So I'd have to use my shin more, which was really unique because Jean-Jacques Machado, Carlos Machado, Higgin, Hozier, John, I've worked with all of them. They don't use their foot. They slide the person's leg up on their shin to lift them. And they're like some of the most epic sweepers there is. He goes, trying to lift somebody down here is very hard. But when I slide them up here, it's very easy. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, boom, there's a piece of the puzzle I needed. Sure, there's a piece of, and so I'd work with different people. And, you know, and Professor Sauer was always like, totally encourages that. He's not one of these instructors that, oh, you cannot train with him. He's not, he was like, I remember I was doing a camp. I said, oh, Professor, I just learned this from Jean-Jacques. He does a camp with Guru Dan and Asanto, Jean-Jacques Pichato. And so he goes, okay, everybody, it's time. Greg Nelson just learned this technique from Jean-Jacques Pichato. Let's see what it is. And bam, he doesn't care.
Yeah, yeah.
He has
yeah.
that open mind.
Right.
And so, which also made me more loyal to him because I'm like, he just wants you to be better.
Yeah, there's no gatekeeping or yeah. whatever. Yeah, yeah.
And then every time you show something, then professor's always there to go, okay, let's see if we can put a little salt and pepper on this. And then all of a sudden you're like, holy crap, that's something I never thought about. And then he'll add a little element to it. And so it's really cool because he's now learning it and then exploring it.
Right.
And so, and he always, I remember Eric Paulson came in. He was in Salt Lake City doing a seminar. And I said, Professor, Eric Paulson's in. He was wondering if he could come in and train. He said, will he come in and teach at my camp?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah. So I partnered up with Professor, and he was like a kid in a candy store. He was loving it. He got to be a student. He was, hey, Eric, come here. Do I put my hand here? Do I put it here? What right. What is the better one?
Oh. Because that really is the essence of learning stuff.
Yes.
Like once you say this guy's in charge and you guys are learning and this is what we're doing, not that, then you're in big, big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so that was this. It's always, and Guru Dan and Asanto is constantly, he's 86. He does privates with people. Every week he's doing privates with Jean-Jacques or one of the brothers there or another Kali guy that just somehow came out of the woodwork. Or some, yeah, I met this Cambodian kickboxer. I work with him every Tuesday. It's like, that's what I want to do.
Is that a relatively novel thing, like in the last 20, 30 years of people just seeking out anything and everything, cross-training more and more? Like, was there an old school martial arts thing at some point where like those guys over there, us over here, those guys over
yeah,
there.
Yeah, definitely was. There was yeah. a time where if you did Japanese karate, you did not talk to a Korean dude. You would have been kicked out of that school. I mean, even was that back in jiu-jitsu?
Sure, yeah.
If you were under
probably
guy,
still is somewhere, some right? Places, it's a human thing.
I just never had to experience it because I was with Professor Sauer.
Yeah.
You know, he was always like, oh, hey.
Open book.
Yeah. You should go work with this guy. Really? Okay. So I never had Guru Dan. It was from Bruce Lee. So it was like, seek it out, man.
Anything everywhere, and everything.
Everywhere yeah, and everything. So that was the whole mentality from the get-go. So everybody I kind of went with was all on that same page. So I never had to, oh, geez, if I go with this guy, so-and-so is going to be mad. He would be like, oh, yeah, that'd be good. Go work with him. Go work with that guy. And so that was one of the cool things about, and Professor Sauer, he'll be at a camp where he'll be doing the jiu-jitsu and Guru Dan will be teaching and Achan Chai will be teaching and Francis Fong will be teaching. So he's in there trying things. And so that was the mentality at the beginning that never left. And I think I always talk about it like this. There are fighters and there are truly mixed martial artists. Like, you know, you have some guys that once their fight career is done, that's it. They're not going to train anymore. They're going to, who knows what they're going to do. They just fight. And then you have other guys, Anderson Silva, you know, I mean, you can name a bunch mm-hmm. of them mm-hmm. that they're done fighting, but they're training martial arts. Anderson Silva is working with Guru Dan and Asanto. He's working with some of my friends that are out there doing Wing Chun and working all these different things because he's a martial artist. You know,
it was as much the pursuit as it was the championship bout.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so you have kind of that two different types of, you know, fighters. And there's going to be the fighters like the Diaz brothers type, which is put those in their thing. They're just going to keep doing jiu-jitsu and they're going to keep doing what they do. They're going to keep, how many squabbles have these dudes been in outside the cage? So who they are
this week, yeah. Probably. Yeah.
And so, but they just do jiu-jitsu and then hey, they fight, but they're martial artists. And I'll tell you this. I remember I was back at one of the fights, Sean Sherk was fighting and we're getting him warmed up. And it was the funniest warm up. I think Nate was fighting and it was Nick. And, one other person, it was literally like they were warming up. It was like a street fight back in there. They were rolling over the chairs. They were hitting the garbage cans. I was like, holy crap, these guys are like street fighting in here, getting warmed up. And then I look over and Nick Diaz is doing like a perfect karate form. He goes, oh, I love karate. And he's going, yay, yay. And he's holding his kick out there and his toes are pulled back. He goes, oh, I love nunchucks too, man. It's so cool. And I'm like,
what?
Wow.
Yeah. The real deal. Huh?
Yeah. You know, and, you know, Lyoto Machida, that dude's not going to stop doing karate.
Right.
And he never stopped when he was fighting. You know, karate sucks. Doesn't work. Well, sorry. Got a guy that's making it work.
Till the foot lands.
Yeah.
Sucks till the foot lands.
And so, you know, you have those guys that are seeking martial arts, seeking continual development.
Do you think you'll see a re-evolution at the highest levels of MMA as people re-expand, shall we say, and say, well, some of those early dudes that were doing those specialized styles, they had some stuff. Kind of like your story, like you do some jiu-jitsu, but it's informed by so many other things.
Yeah,
Do you think you see a re-diversification at the high levels in MMA?
Well, I think we're definitely seeing it because more fighters are seeking out different types of training. Sure. Right, they're working with different strikers, they're working with different jiu-jitsu people, and they're working with wrestlers, and they're bringing everybody in. And the other thing too is, like I said, there'll be the fighters that once they're done fighting, that's it. They're going to do something else. And then you got the fighters that are fighters, and they maybe came from a wrestling background, but they started learning all this stuff, and now they want to keep doing this. So I gotta keep learning. And if I want to open a school, how am I going to, if I'm only dealing with fighters, good luck, unless you're a major, big, giant place like, you know, Jackson's or Killcliff, who are backed by a ton of money that can just do this. Or are you going to be like a huge percentage of the schools that 99% of the people in there are students, and you have this small pocket of people. I mean, I think our biggest fight team ever has been about like 20 consistent fighters. That's it. You ain't making money on that.
No.
You're not making a living.
Mm-mm.
You know, you're going to train out of the garage, you know?
Right.
So even here, we have 99% of our people are just training martial arts for a variety of reasons.
Yep. Yeah, staying in shape and self-defense.
Yeah, all those things. And then we have our fighters, and a lot of those fighters, which I try to encourage, like John Castaneda, he'll be in jiu-jitsu class. He'll be, you know, the ones will be in, you know, striking classes, Thai boxing classes. They're intermixing with the students. They get tapped out by them. They don't care because they know that they're really good fighters.
Yeah.
And they're having fun with it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I want. That's what I want. I want to encourage that. I remember Sean Sherk was like that. He would let somebody tap him out. Oh, man, that was really good. And that guy would walk out like, oh, man, I just got Sean in. And it was like, oh, good job. And yeah. Sean didn't care because he could have crinkled him up like a piece of tinfoil and threw him in the garbage somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But he was playing. Or the other thing like Sean would do is he'd say, hey, okay, you know how to do triangle choke? Yep. Okay. Put it on. And I want you to get my head. And if you can finish me, I'm going to tap and that'll be super awesome. But I'm going to try to work my way out of it. And every once in a while, you know, he'd have to tap. He'd go, do that again. Exactly the same. That was the best. And then pretty soon, really, do I have to do this? I can't finish it. Nobody can finish it. And, you know, he would do that with everything. Guillotines. He goes, yeah. I got to be really good at getting out of guillotines because I shoot doubles. And everybody knows I'm going to shoot a double. Mm-hmm. So I got to figure it out. So here's how we're going to start. You got it super tight? Let's do this. And he would, that's how he'd play. That's how he got really good. And he'd be in shooto class, Thai boxing class, you know, MMA. He'd come into jiu-jitsu. He'd have this old judo top on with these yellow sweatpants and his belt on. But he was doing jiu-jitsu.
Yeah. And I like the constraints thing. I mean, it becomes a point where every training partner you had can't handle the constraints you're giving them or whatever.
Yeah.
That's a bummer for them and good for you. But yeah. I mean, yeah. That's what was forced on you coming out of the cancer thing. Okay, a whole new set of constraints. I got to learn and find new space. Huh?
Yeah.
What's going on with the current fight team here? Who's got stuff coming up and who's braggable right now?
Well, we have a lot of good fighters. And, you know, obviously John Castaneda, he's in UFC. Rose Namajunas comes in for half her fight camps all the time. And so she just left like a month ago, I think it was, or maybe a little less than that. And she's got a fight coming up on the 23rd. You know, we got Quang, who's fighting at the LFA. Candace Swanson fighting at the LFA. Mitch Wilson's fighting at the LFA coming up. We're hopefully getting Griffin Perriott there as well. And so there are a lot of up-and-comers. Probably Quang's the one that's closest to making that next jump to another level. So he's doing well. We have people that are competing in, you know, various grappling things. Katie's doing really well in grappling. Hayden's doing really well in grappling. Obviously, you have, you know, our other guys that are grappling. So the goal is, you know, having that group of people that are doing well in all of them. And because then the fighters that are in MMA can grapple with these really high-level no-gi grapplers, and they have to figure it out. And then every once in a while, they'll get up on their feet and go with the really good wrestler. And because they're trying to figure it out. And that's what I always say is that ultimately the greatest thing I could hope for as a school owner is that once the door's unlocked and they just walk in, they got people here that can be who they need them to be better.
Right.
And then
depending on what blade you need sharpened, yes, we got a guy for that.
Got a guy for that. And, you know, and for me, my goal is just because of I think what I'm really good at because of all the different things I'm taking from. When someone has a question, I have this pinball, boom, and there's the answer. It comes, this was kind of like from, you know, this style of wrestling. I think it would be perfect right here. And the guy's a wrestler, he understands it. But then if it's a jiu-jitsu person, I go, check this out. This is more from, you know, what I learned from this person who has a very similar style to yours. And then it's on stand-up, I can go, this is something that I think because you're not much of a kicker, you're really good boxing, I can take from this element of boxing I learned. And then you got another guy who's like, you're more like a Savat guy. You move like your footwork's all over the place. This is the kick you need. This is the one that's going to work because I got the answer from Savat. And so I'm able to grab from so many different sources that it's, in fact, that I competed in all, you know, fought Thai boxing, fought judo, MMA, gi jiu-jitsu, no gi, boxed, you know, wrestled, then my unsanctioned bouts all over the place, you know, so had a lot of experience. So I understand the pressure, I understand the feel, I understand the mechanics of what needs to be done there. And so being able to pick and choose, you know, what needs to be done for that individual, I think I have a really good understanding of that, regardless of where it's coming from.
Seems like a superpower.
I love it. I think, and for me too, it's like people are like, what keeps you going? I always say, I just love it. I don't have an answer for you, man. That's it. I love training. I love teaching. I love figuring stuff out. I've always have. Doesn't matter if it, you know, I still teach Kali. I still do straightforward jiu-jitsu. I still do grappling. I still so shudo. I teach Muay Thai. I have people that want to work elements of Wing Chun. I'll work with them. I have Wing Chun Dummy at my house. I train on that. I have people that want to do hubad, the Filipino martial arts. I've taught Rose how to do hubad and her how to do sombrado with the sticks because she's a martial artist and wanted to learn it. And so I still do all the stuff I started with Rick Fay in his garage in 1983. It just has a different look now because I'm coming from a different, you know, different time, different era, but I still get to train it all.
You have better mats.
Yes, way better mats.
This is the main thing.
We had this when we first started.
Right, right. Carpet. Usually one of the last things I'll bring up, I'll let you frame it however you want to frame it. A lot of times these are just straight up jujitsu dorks on here. Mm-hmm. So I'll say, give me advice as a white belt and then give me advice as a blue belt and so on and so on. I'll just open it up wide relative to however you want to phrase it. And if I'm coming in here to train, to be a fighter, to do some jujitsu, give me advice.
The first thing I would always tell people is, you know why you're coming in here, right? And especially as a new person and then as a person coming up, you got to enjoy it. You got to have fun. You got to have fun with it. Don't put these crazy expectations on yourself. Have fun with it. Just learn. Know that you get to come in and train. And the other thing I always say is, and this has been my life since I was a gymnast, and my daughter will tell you the same thing. She was a really high-level gymnast. I say, what's gymnastics, Nina? And she'll go, fail, fail, fail until you don't. And then we learn new moves to fail, fail, fail until we don't. And that's what we do. And I go, that's what we do in jiu-jitsu. We have such a great sport and great martial art that encourages you to tap. So you tap a lot and tap often. And Professor Sauer said the same thing. He goes, I must have tapped a million times on my way to black belt. That's a million things I've learned along the way. And I said, you don't want to come in here thinking that I got to fight my way through everything. No, you learn so much by your mistakes. And you learn so much by tapping. So, man, I encourage that. Have fun with it. Don't be so worried about whether you win or lose on the mat. You know, we always had this little comedy thing that we always say. Eric Paulson said it first. He goes, hey, all you guys who did really good today, make sure you go to jimwins.com and mark your record. Said there, nobody cares.
Yeah,
nobody cares. So have fun with it and just enjoy the journey, because that's what it's about. It's about the process.
Cool. Thanks, brother.
Yeah, awesome.
Thanks everyone for tuning in to another episode of the Pohata Podcast. And hey, if you're a regular listener, head on over to the Pohata Podcast on Instagram, where amongst the ridiculous memes you'll find a link to the merch shop and be able to keep up with the disorganized going-ons of the show. And hey, before you go, here's a little preview of an upcoming episode.
I think what it comes down to is that in the last, like, 2 weeks, you get very emotional. Your emotions are very running high, and you express them, like, at the drop of a hat. Like, they just come out. And then I'm the opposite. I, like, run out of emotions at the end. Like, I have no feelings. Like, I am not angry or sad or happy or anything. I have no feelings, and I'm very, like, quiet. Like, I withdraw a little bit. So I think, like, we just tend to maybe rub each other the wrong way at the end, because he's, like, explosive. Almost, that's not the right word. But little, you're very, like, expressive.
Yeah.
Very expressive. Very high emotions. And I'm just so, like, sometimes I'm just, like, stop.